From WBUR in Boston, it's Weekly Warm-Up, a sampling of the cornucopia of stories and interviews featured on Only a Game, sports public radio style.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new turbocharged Acura RDX with available voice-activated navigation. More at acura.com/RDX.
Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Billy Donovan certainly didn't need the money. The University of Florida men's basketball coach was about to sign a 7-year contract worth nearly $25 million. He didn't need the prestige. The Gators had just won their second consecutive championship, and the 42-year-old was one of the brightest stars in the constellation of college coaches. So it shocked many observers when Donovan announced last week that he had signed a contract to become the new coach of the NBA's Orlando Magic. The decision also apparently shocked Coach Donovan, so he changed his mind. Joining me on the line to wade through all this is ESPN.com columnist Pat Forty. Pat, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill. Good to be here.
A coach changing his mind isn't new, but a college coach rejecting the NBA, that's got to be a violation of some sort of bylaw somewhere, right?
Yeah, you know, I mean, because they all want to go up to that pro level, it seems, a level where they really don't perform well. But it was very surprising to see Billy turn down the money and the challenge of something that he felt like he could do after succeeding as well as he did in college. And I mean, I have to say, I think that in the end, he got it right. I think that it was a very bad decision by him to go to the NBA, and in the end, he changed his mind and came to his senses.
Well, the NBA was not entirely happy with the reversal. It seemed as if the Magic and the league took Donovan's about-face rather personally. The deal that freed the coach to return to his college job included a 5-year non-compete clause that will prevent him from coaching in the NBA during that time. Why not just tear up the contract, shake hands, and let bygones be bygones?
You know, I think that, first of all, they were very put off by the way Billy did, you know, go through and physically sign the contract and do the press conference and then turn around 3-4 days later. And I think that maybe this is a preemptive strike trying to say, you know what, this seems to be a bit of an advancing trend in coaching, especially with college coaches, where you agree to something and then you change your mind, and it's not going to fly in the NBA. I think that was the bottom line there, that, you know, the Magic felt burned, and the NBA wanted to make sure that they don't get burned in the future.
Billy Donovan may have made the smart move, as you began to suggest a minute ago. The NBA landscape is littered with the carcasses of college coaches Mike Montgomery, John Calipari, Tim Floyd, Rick Pitino, at least as he performed in Boston, who thought they could make the jump to the NBA. Why is that transition so hard?
You know, I think a couple of things. First of all, most college coaches that succeed are good recruiters and motivators. Those two clubs are out of your bag, if you will, at the NBA level. You know, motivation is generally, it counts on coming from the players. It's not, you know, the guy, they're not going to respond to, you know, rah-rah speeches. Most of them make more money than college coaches. College coaches like to have a lot of control, and those guys, they're not going to be in control in those situations. And the other thing is they go out and recruit players and generally get the rosters they want, and most of these guys have stepped into situations where they don't have good players, and it's up to the front office to get them, and it's a little bit harder in the NBA, given the salary cap, to, you know, just go out and get new guys every year. So I think there's kind of a compilation of things, but you're right, the track record is pretty dismal.
Based on what you've said about motivation, it strikes me that a college coach coming to a pro team that was overwhelmingly young might have a better shot. But that's just a guess. What has caused some college coaches to succeed at the pro level?
You know, I think that you do have to get into the right situation. You get a coachable star, for one thing, and then you can put some other pieces around him. Then, you know, yeah, you can see succeed. It's not like Rick Pitino can't coach. It's not like John Calipari can't coach. But they made some poor personnel decisions. They didn't handle the losing aspect of it very well. But if you get in the right spot, like Pitino did with the Knicks, you know, you can succeed.
In part because the turnover in college ball is so quick. Sometimes guys just go to school for a year or two and then go to the NBA. The biggest stars in college basketball are often the coaches, but in the NBA it's the players that are on the marquee. Do college coaches with large egos just find that too tough to handle?
I think that's part of the equation, definitely, because you're right that the coaches are the stars of the show in college, and you know, everything's kind of geared toward them. You know, there are, you know, players can't get endorsements, so the coaches get all of those, and there's, you know, 25 sideline shots per game of the coaches, and you know, most of the commentators are friendly with the coaches, and so they will, you know, preach or sing their praises endlessly. You know, I think the different dynamic of the pros is difficult for a lot of them to handle because, you know, they are prop. Mike Brown, who cares about who Mike Brown is? You know, it's LeBron James and the Cavaliers, and it's Tim Duncan and the Spurs. It's not Greg Popovich. So it's a completely different dynamic.
This is leading me to think that maybe Texas Tech's Bob Knight and Duke's Mike Krzyzewski are even smarter than people have been telling me for years that they are, because they've turned down lots and lots of offers to coach in the pros and stay in the college ranks.
Oh, yeah. I think, you know, it's good to be king, and they are definitely kings of their respective kingdoms. And you know, I could you imagine Bob Knight trying to get his act to fly in an NBA locker room? I think he's smart enough to know that he's in the right place for him.
Coach Donovan claimed that he realized after signing the contract with the Magic that he belonged in college basketball. How long before attorneys acting on his behalf try to get that 5-year ban overturned so he can change his mind again?
Well, you know, I talked to Billy this week, and he came across very sincerely saying that, you know, he's fine with the 5-year ban because he knows that college is where he wants to be. But you never say never with these guys. And, you know, the one thing is he is friendly with Pat Riley, and Pat Riley's not going to coach forever at the Heat. And who wouldn't want a chance to coach Dwayne Wade? So it's not out of the question. But for now, I will go along with his sincere pitch that he is in college for the foreseeable future.
Pat Forte is a national columnist for ESPN.com, and he does that wholeheartedly, I'm quite sure. Pat, thanks again.
All right. Thank you, Bill.
Coming up on Only a Game, Chicago's Hombres Peligrosos y Misteriosos. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce, who's in NPR's New York Bureau, for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
I don't know if you're presently wearing your NASCAR hat. If you are, this would be the appropriate time to tip it as I ask you to say a few words about Bill France Jr., who died on Monday at the age of 74.
He was at the age of 74, and still people referred to his father as Big Bill.
Mm-hmm.
Go figure. The man who brought NASCAR to the position where it is right now, which is to say in places like Arizona and New Hampshire, the absolute final authority of all things stock car. And a guy who saw a wild and completely unpredictable, in the sense of nobody could predict it, expansion of a sport that was regional and is now no more southern than the National Hockey League is Canadian.
The San Antonio Spurs surprised almost nobody with their easy handling of the Cleveland Cavaliers on Thursday night. Was that prelude to a sweep?
No, I think the Cavaliers will come back and get one for the home folks. I think they lose this in five. If somehow LeBron James were able to carry this collection of rodeo clowns to an NBA title, it would be a greater thing than Michael Jordan ever did when he had Bill Cartwright at center. It just isn't going to happen. San Antonio's been in this position too many times before. Tim Duncan is still probably the best player in the league. They've got Bruce Bowen to thug it up. Jupiter is aligning with five games at this point. It's enormously, enormously predictable.
Speaking of the Cavaliers, Ohio's governor, Ted Strickland, has gone on record as supporting a gigantic billboard of King James. The federal government wants the billboard removed because it's 2.5 times the maximum size allowed near interstate highways. But Governor Strickland says, and I quote, "There's something spiritual about this presentation." Exactly when did a photo of a basketball star and a Nike swoosh become, quote, spiritual?
Oh, about $90 million ago, I would say. Yes, I mean, it's very spiritual in the same sense that the giant Buddhas that got blown up in Afghanistan was. You build something big enough and it becomes sacred. It's the American way.
Charlie, my understanding of the NBA draft has been that after Greg Oden and Kevin Durant, nobody else matters. So how did Kevin Durant so suddenly drop from very desirable to utterly suspect?
Well, because a lot of people seem to think the NBA is a weightlifting contest.
Uh-huh.
He went to what the NBA has for a combine and failed to bench press or otherwise lift 185 pounds, which makes people wonder if whether or not he can stand up to the pounding of an 82-game season, considering he's going to be playing probably a forward position. it doesn't devalue him enough to push him out of the top two. As his coach Rick Barnes said, there are lots of guys who can lift weights who can't play dead in a cowboy movie.
I like that, too. I think that's very good. The Orlando Magic named Stan Van Gundy their head coach on Thursday, Charlie. How much of Mr. Van Gundy's salary does Billy Donovan, whom Mr. Van Gundy replaced, have to pay?
Oh, I don't think any. I think this worked out for everyone, the best for all concerned, although I was rather amused at Billy Donovan's sudden discovery that when he took the job in Orlando that he had children, which I thought was remarkable. Oh, wait, I have children. I
better stay here.
I have to watch them play Little League. I have to stay where I am now. I'm sorry. They get this. I'm sorry. This eluded me somehow. Anyway, Stan Van Gundy's a really good NBA coach. Orlando got the best possible alternative to the guy they wanted.
You have spoken in the past about how ineffective Gene Upshaw has been at securing the rights, health, and safety of the members of the National Football League Players Union. Now he's threatening to break Hall of Fame guard Joe DeLaMalur's neck. What did Mr. DeLaMalur do to irk Mr. Upshaw?
Well, he intimated that the union has done far less than it should have in addressing, among other things, the myriad health issues afflicting people who played in the NFL in a less enlightened age, and he's absolutely right about that. The idea that we're just now coming to address the effects of post-concussion syndrome and everything else, let alone the fact that everybody who played in the NFL for longer than 10 years has two plastic knees and two titanium hips. Gene Upshaw is a creature of management. He always has been. That's the way management wants it. And for all of Roger Goodell's wonderful noises about how they're really going to take care of this problem, appointing another task force and having Gene Upshaw agree with you in doing so is not addressing the problem. It's talking about the problem.
Since Street Smart, the winner of the Kentucky Derby, did not win the Preakness, the number of people paying attention to today's Belmont Stakes is considerably smaller than it would otherwise have been. But I'm sure you're paying attention, and you know which horse is going to win, right?
Well, as you know, Bill, prior to being Mr. NASCAR, I was Mr. Horse Racing.
I didn't know that. I'm thrilled to learn
right
it.
That was before I got my driver's license. And so using my highly scientific method and my buyer speed figures and my deep knowledge of breeding going all the way back to equipoise, I'm going to pick the horse with my initials, CP West.
Oh, excellent.
Even though I'm East.
Over the years, lots of cities hosting the Olympics have been accused of all sorts of bad behavior in preparation for the Games. But if the Geneva-based Center on Housing Rights and Evictions has its numbers right, China is going to set the world record for dislocations.
1.5 million people will be moved or otherwise shuffled off so the world can have its quadrennial track meet. Please, somebody covering this Olympics, point out in at least one story that the Olympics aren't worth discomfiting a million and a half people. This is not an event worth all this bother. Please don't bid on it anymore.
Here's my candidate for most shocking sports headline of the week. Tour de France director can't guarantee clean race.
No!
Shocked.
No! Is he just sort of giving up lying about it, too, or what? Lie to us, please! I don't know if I can go on with this.
Troy Ellerman, who says journalists hounded him for transcripts of testimony in the Balco case, is now facing prison for leaking those documents. Does the identification of the attorney, Mr. Ellerman, as the source of the leaks mean Mark Fainaruwata and Lance Williams are off the hook?
Apparently not. What they're being pursued for is the fact that they actually had the grand jury stuff. Mr. Ellerman sounds like a real prize. These guys put themselves on the line for 2 years, and now he's blaming them for getting him in trouble for leaking the testimony. But, you know, the journalism in this story has been right on the edge the whole way. And if you are going to lie down with this particular dog, you are going to wind up getting up with all kinds of fleas.
Roger Clemens pitches tonight for the Yankees. No, he doesn't. Which is it?
I don't know. I'm still shocked about the Tour de France. Is his groin now no longer fatigued?
I hate it that a groin is national news. The state of someone's groin should be a private matter.
I don't know. I don't understand why we have to know it's tuckered out. I really don't.
Me neither. Gary Sheffield of the Detroit Tigers said this week that he meant nothing derogatory toward Latin players when he said recently that Major League Baseball found it easier to control Latinos than black players. Any chance he gets away with that non-apology?
Oh, absolutely not, because he was being an idiot. This was a hassle nobody needed to have, and I don't care how real Sheff wants to keep it. He said something stupid. It was exactly what he believed, and nobody's going to believe his apology.
Actor Rob Lowe got a birdie during a celebrity golf tournament last weekend, and he really wishes that he hadn't. Discuss.
This is an interesting thing. Not only did he literally kill a bird in mid-flight with one of his shots, he killed a goldfinch. And not only did he kill a goldfinch, but by killing the goldfinch, he killed the state bird of Iowa.
Gonna this do is it. The do worst, it right.
This is the worst problem Rob Lowe has had with a video camera since 1988, and we're not going to get into that.
I wouldn't.
But he apparently took it in good grace, if the bird didn't, and made a joke saying that that was his birdie for the day. Ha ha.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
An unclean Tour de France. How will I go on?
Lucha Libre wrestling has been a staple of Mexican sports culture for decades. During the sport's golden age in the 1950s and 60s, the masked men were kings of the ring and could be seen in comic books, movies, and on TV for the match of the week. Today, luchadores, as they're called, are drawing fans in the United States, with weekly matches in California, Colorado, and Texas. In Chicago, a new company is promoting local talent to go head-to-head with their legendary counterparts south of the border. Yolanda Perdomo has the story.
At Cicero Stadium, an announcer greets spectators as they make their way to the grandstands and dozens of ringside seats.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We're 5 minutes away from our start. People are still coming in. As soon as everyone is in, we'll start the show.
Actually, that's the show before the show, which includes an Elvis impersonator singing his greatest hits, followed by a 9-piece mariachi band. Eric Herman is president of EMLI, the Empresa Mexicana of Lucha Libre International, a Chicago-based company that manages over 30 local wrestlers to compete against superstars from Mexico. Herman says giving the people a little extra is what Lucha Libre is all about.
So for respect to our people, we have to put a show before to start the match, because it's very important to keep the people happy there in the business, you know. Maybe, you know, the ladies doesn't care about the matches, but maybe they like the mariachis show or the Elvis show or the Aztec dancers show. So that's why, because we try to put some event very interesting for the people.
While the mask is still the hallmark of Lucha Libre, one Chicago wrestler, El Gringo Loco, says he doesn't need one because, as he puts it...
No, it's because I'm very handsome. It's impossible for me to wear a mask.
Not surprisingly, people love to hate El Gringo Loco. Entering the arena in stars and stripes spandex, he taunts the predominantly Latino crowd by throwing out tortillas, only to have them thrown back at him. Gringo Loco's alter ego is 21-year-old Charlie Santo. He's been wrestling lucha libre and American-style wrestling for the past 8 years and says lucha libre is unique in that it has both style and substance.
American wrestling, there's more comical in lucha libre, more comedy, more fun, more entertainment value of it, whereas in American wrestling it's just these big jacked-up monsters who don't really have a lot of talent. In American wrestling, a lot of people go just to see freaks of nature, if you will. Like in WWF or WWE, you know, it's more of a freak show, if you will. Here it's more entertainment and more of a show.
That comes in the form of acrobatic leaps and landings, as well as intricately detailed costumes that complement the masks. With names like Psychosis, Angel of Death, and Charlie Manson Jr., most Lucha Libre fighters present a nefarious image. But Chicago's El Pato Loco, or Crazy Duck, looks like a cross between Tweety Bird and Donald Duck. A big orange bill protrudes from his mask, and his baggy yellow pleather pants are held up by suspenders. Unlike Gringo Loco, he's a crowd favorite, especially with the children. Pato is from Mexico, but has lived in Chicago for 20 years, working for a maintenance company. He started Lucha Libre Wrestling 2 years ago.
I don't have a special move. The thing is, my special move is to see the faces happy, smiling for the kids. That's my special move for me. People call my name. That's made me so happy.
The shows combine acrobatic and athletic prowess, and for Latinos living in the United States, Lucha Libre is also a connection to their culture. Jesus Torres is from Mexico and has lived in Chicago for several years. He says watching Lucha Libre in this country fosters a great sense of pride for his countrymen.
It's a sport that the Mexican culture enjoys because it demonstrates attitude. It demonstrates power from one fighter to another. The rivalry between the good and the bad guys, like the battle between good and evil itself.
Next to soccer, Lucha Libre is the biggest spectator sport in Mexico. Torres adds that for many people like him, it's like bringing a slice of Mexico to enjoy in the U.S.
Many people who've lived in the United States for years, to bring this type of event, they remember memories of the movies, which were popular a long time ago. Santo, of Mil Mascaras, of Blue Demon. A lot of Mexican people come to remember and to forget for a little while about their problems at work, and they feel as if they were back home. And that's what's most important, to feel as if they're in an arena in Mexico.
While Lucha Libre is well known throughout Latin America, people in the U.S. are now getting a taste of Mexican-style wrestling outside the ring, thanks to Mucha Lucha, which airs on the Cartoon Network, and Nacho Libre, the Jack Black comedy in which Phil Janis first saw Lucha Libre. He drove from the northwestern suburb of Rolling Meadows, Illinois, with his two sons to see their first ever live lucha show in April.
It's interesting. It's a spectacle. It's eye candy. Just because it's more family. You look around, there's children of every age. I mean, it's family.
As to whether the sport will catch on with American audiences, only familiar with offerings from the WWE, Janis is sure that if you showcase it, they will come.
Yes, if they come to it, yes, because I'm enjoying it. And I don't see why you wouldn't. It's a good family. It's good to come with the family.
The EMLLI says the success of April's Cicero Stadium Showdown, which was taped to air on Azteca America's Gladiadores de la Lucha, will hopefully give them more chances to produce future events for fighters and fans alike. The next Lucha Libre Spectacular is set for tonight at Cicero Stadium. For Only a Game, I'm Yolanda Perdomo in Chicago.
Thanks for listening to Only a Game. Please check your local listings for the NPR station nearest you to carry our show, and please visit our website, onlyagame.org.